You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of sports have no fans in the stands these days. A Wisconsin sports psychologist tells us how that affects players on the field, especially in youth sports. Now, every week on Food Friday, we get some advice on good cooking. But here's a Monday twist. We want to hear from you about your worst moments in bad cooking at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You may know what I'm talking about. The one big mistake, the dish that went wrong, maybe just at the wrong time. I'll share some of mine. I have enough to fill a whole conversation, but mainly I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Tell us about the time you used sugar instead of salt, or vice versa. The hot dish that burst into flames. The experiment that stretched the boundaries of edibility. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What prompted this? We've done this before, and it's been a lot of fun. We've heard great stories for you. A couple things over the weekend. A thing on Twitter, some random person, I don't know, shared they'd a text conversation with their cousin. The cousin asks, how often do you clean your oven? You know, he's new to cooking. Pretty much never. The cousin says, really? I clean it every time I use it. Really? Why? Well, it gets all the grease and blood on the bottom of it. You mean the baking sheet? Baking sheet? I just put the meat right on the grill and let it go. So that got a lot of play. And I feel for this person. I was not much better than that in my 20s. And then I had a little incident this weekend that I was able to fix. I was making soup, butternut squash soup, with roasted onions. And I had these sprigs of fresh rosemary. And I thought I'll do the rosemary like bay leaves. I'll put it in. When it tastes enough like rosemary, I'll take it out. So far, so good. I tasted it. It's like, oh, that's plenty of rosemary taste. I don't want any more than that in there. I find the sprig of rosemary, pull it out, and all the leaves had come off of it. So then I spent 15 or 20 minutes fishing with a fork, fishing rosemary leaves out of the hot soup. So it did, because it would have tasted like nothing but rosemary by the time it was done. Fixed, soup ended up coming out good. So not a full-on disaster. How about you share your bad cooking story now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Well, and speaking of bay leaves, that reminds me of my worst one in my early 20s. I didn't know what was up with bay leaves. I'd bought some. I was like, hey, I hear these are good. I was making spaghetti. I had bay leaves. All these things are really tough, but I guess they soften up when you cook them. So I diced up the bay leaves and threw them in the spaghetti sauce to simmer. And what I know now that I didn't know then is they don't soften up. So I basically laced my spaghetti with these really dangerous shards of bay leaf. I ate all the spaghetti, but I had to pick carefully through it. And I lived to tell the tale. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Samantha is with us in Independence. Hi there, Samantha.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is when I was younger. I was probably still in school. My grandma, we lived out in a rural farm, so she went into town, and I was old enough to stay by myself at her house. But I wanted to make cookies, so I got her molasses cookie recipe out and tried making cookies by myself. Burn the sheet, burn the inside of the stove, and you could smell that molasses for days in that house. And oh my God, the look on my face, you know, I just started bawling, and my grandma got mad. And then after a while, she said, it's okay, we can throw the pan out. You know?
Yeah, you don't want to clean
oh
that.
My goodness.
How old are you, Samantha?
I was probably in maybe like sixth grade, maybe. Probably
okay.
Old enough to be on my own and be home and know enough, but I just thought, well, I'll make her some cookies, because she always had cookies around. She didn't have any. Yeah.
Have you ever gone back and made molasses cookies right, Samantha?
No, I've been afraid to make them ever since I burnt them then. But I'd like to make them again, but I just got scared. I'll start it again, you know.
Thank you, Samantha, so much for getting us started at 800-642-1234, taking your calls or Facebook comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page with your bad cooking adventures. Let's bring on another caller now. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Hi, Cindy.
Oh, my first turkey I spoiled. I cleaned out the cavity, but I did not know the neck cavity had the, you know, with the plastic bag with the the gizzards and stuff in it, and I baked that turkey with that plastic stuffing, and that whole turkey tasted like plastic.
Oh, no. You are not the only person who's ever done that. I promise you, Cindy. I haven't encountered that myself. Have you gone back? Have you gotten back on the wagon and tried making a turkey yourself?
Oh, I've done. Yeah, this was my first turkey after I moved away from home. So I've done lots of turkey since. I mean, I learned my lesson, but you know, you just feel so stupid.
Well, did you eat the whole thing?
Well, we ate parts of it. I mean, I had people over, and that was pretty much the, you know, that was the meal with the sides.
Oh, no.
But you know, yeah. Right. But the rest of it probably went in the garbage.
Lesson learned, Cindy. Thank you so much for calling in at 800-642-1234. Jan has a story with us. Jan in Madison. Hi, Jan.
Hello. Yes, it's fun thinking about this, but my guests weren't really very happy about this. I was having this fondue, and a guy at work had told me how he cooked chicken in the fondue pot, and it was cooked in a Swiss cheese and wine sauce. So, I invited my friends over, and we, cut up the chicken, and we put it on the little forks and stuck it in there, and as soon as it got in there, all this blood started swirling around because it wasn't cooked. It wasn't already cooked. My friend at work never said you have to cook the chicken first. So here we are, and my friends are going, ew, ew, it's bloody. Ooh, I can't eat it. I'm like, I'm hardcore, so I'm like, look, it's cooked. I'm eating it. So I ate it, and finally they said, we're getting a pizza.
Fair enough.
So they got a pizza, and that was the end of the fondue. So,
wow.
Anyway, it makes a good memory.
Thank you so much. Wow. I don't know how you follow that one up. That does remind me. This isn't a bad cooking story exactly. My my grandmother, when I was living with roommates in my 20s, had made an apple pie. Gave it to me, but it wasn't cooked. It's layered, and I'm supposed to put it in the oven, right, and finish it up. I get home one day, open up the pie to bake it, and there's a piece missing. I said to my roommate, did you eat some of this pie? Yeah. It's not cooked, man. I said, oh, I didn't want to say anything. I thought your grandma was just a terrible baker. Yeah, raw pie, not the way to go. Back to your calls now. Barb is with us in Jackson County. Barb, hi.
Hi, I'm remembering all kinds of cooking. Years ago, I made homemade lasagna from scratch, and I was having some friends over. And right when they arrived, we heard some noise in the oven, and I opened it, and the Pyrex glass pan that I had it in broke, and the cheese was dripping all over the oven.
Oh, no.
We all just stood there and went, oh, no. So I turned off the oven, I shut it, and I was going to deal with it the next day, and we got our coats, and we went out to eat.
That must have been a fun cleanup, too, I bet.
Oh, it was terrible.
Broken glass and charred cheese.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Well,
so,
but that one, I feel like that one's not on you, Barb. I mean, the pan broke. You didn't do anything wrong, though, right?
No, but, you know, lasagna is labor-intensive and lots of cheese, and, you know, it was sad. It was...
Oh, yeah, that's a kick in the head. Wow.
Yeah, I'm thinking about all different ones. This is a good show.
Thank you. Yeah, we're having a lot of fun. Let's time for another caller or two. John is with us in Heartland. John, hi.
Hello there.
All right, what do you got for us, John?
Well, years ago, again, like a lot of the stories, I guess, at home with my wife and her two sons, their early teens, we decided that we wanted to make a bloomin' onion a la Outback Steakhouse or whatever.
Sure.
Fill a pot of oil and get it all heated up, get the cutter and cut the onions and get it dipped up and everything. Dip it into the pot and realize we overfilled it with oil, and that oil just boiled all over the sides of the pot, started on fire.
Oh, no.
And we all kind of stood there and went, now what do we do?
What did you do?
ultimately, I'm trying to remember what we did. I think I threw a cover on it and maybe threw some baking soda on it or something like that.
Oh, good call. Not water.
We took care of it. It didn't cause any damage or problems. We just didn't have a blooming onion that night.
All right. Thank you so much. Wow. One more caller, Kurt in Toma. Kurt, hi.
Hey, how are you? So, tattling on my wife and then my bad too, early marriage, making Kool-Aid for the kids and ran out of sugar. So I tried powdered sugar instead. That didn't work. But my lovely wife made a great tortilla soup but instead of a teaspoon, it was a tablespoon, and instead of chili powder, it was cayenne pepper.
Oh.
So beyond spicy, picante, you know, it just burned. It was good as long as you just kept eating it. But
you need to drink plenty of that powdered sugar Kool-Aid to wash that down, Kurt.
That's right. So
thanks.
Watch it as a substitute, yeah.
Thanks so much. Thanks for all of your calls. That was a lot of fun, everybody. Keep sharing your bad cooking moments over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Between now and next month's general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and on The Morning Show. You can find all these interviews at WPR.org/politics. Right now, we're going to talk about the race to replace Republican James Sensenbrenner as representative for Wisconsin's 5th congressional district. That includes the north and west suburbs of Milwaukee and parts of Dodge, Waukesha, and Milwaukee counties. Tom Palzowitz is a former treasurer at U.S. Bank Mortgage Corporation. He co-founded a business coaching company with his brother. He's running as a Democrat against State Senate Majority Leader and Republican Scott Fitzgerald, who declined our request for an interview. Tom Palzowitz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Why should voters in the 5th choose you to represent them in Washington?
Yeah, great question. A whole bunch of different reasons. You know, when I turned 18, Jim Sensenbrenner was my congressman, and I'm 58 and he's still my congressman. It's really time for a change in this district. We need somebody who actually wants to represent the people of the district, because this district cares about healthcare. They care about solving the pandemic. They care about income inequality. They care about the Black Lives Matter movement, and, you know, they care about gun violence prevention, and they care about climate. So there's a lot of things that need to happen in Washington that haven't been happening, and I think it's time to have a Democrat represent us in this district.
Let's tackle some of the issues you just raised. Healthcare, a big issue again in this election, a challenge to the Affordable Care Act coming before the U.S. Supreme Court after Election Day. If it's overturned, it's in its entirety, that's maybe a big if, what would you do to try to start from scratch with a new healthcare plan?
Yeah, I'll say that's a big if, but I think there's going to be something happening with the Affordable Care Act. But what needs to happen is we need to move to a universal healthcare plan. You know, I've been a business owner for a while, and I've talked to a whole bunch of other business owners. We need to decouple healthcare from the labor market. It's really holding us back as a country from a competitive standpoint, and it's just not fair to companies and workers. There's so many people who would be starting companies, would move jobs more quickly, would go to get more retraining if healthcare was covered without having to be covered through a job. And then the other part is we need to make sure people with pre-existing conditions are covered. We need to make sure people have access to affordable care, and all those things aren't happening right now. I think we should move the Medicare age down to about 50. I think we should strengthen Medicaid. I think the goal, step number one, is get people covered. And then step number two, let's start bringing those costs down and get to a more proactive healthcare system versus a reactive healthcare system.
Related to the health issue, the pandemic, obviously one of the biggest stories, maybe the biggest story in the United States this year. What do you think needs to happen at the federal level that isn't happening right now?
Well, first off, we need a national mask mandate, you know, and it's really going to take a change in leadership. Our president has been consistently the same, that he doesn't think there should be a federal response to what's happening right now. He's left it up to the states. Our state has taken the same exact idea, and they think it should be left up to local officials. And we're in the middle of probably the worst outbreak in Wisconsin that we've ever had. So we need a national mask mandate. We need national contact tracing. We need testing. We need social distancing. But what we really need is we need to pass another stimulus bill that makes sure we can bridge the gap for businesses who feel like they have to open in the face of putting not only themselves and their employees, but their customers at risk. We need to get money into their hands so they can bridge this gap between where we are and when we have a vaccine. And that's something I think that needs to happen in Washington relatively soon.
That is a big debate in Congress and with the White House right now. What specific sorts of things would you like to see targeted in a potential stimulus package? Who would you want to prioritize?
Well, first off, we need to get money into everybody's hands. So I'm a big believer that we need another stimulus check of at least $1,200 into almost everyone's hands. State and local municipalities, they're under tremendous revenue drop pressure. They're trying to fill the gap with budgets now, but it's only going to get worse if they don't get some help. In the hospitality industry, I mean, there's a whole bunch of bars and restaurants and hotels and you name it that are all plugged into people being able to go out and enjoy life socially that it's just not happening now. And unless we step in and really help not only maintain their ownership positions, but make sure they can make payroll, that's the key thing here, is otherwise we're going to have this second economic wave of people losing their jobs. They're also going to lose their health care in the middle of a pandemic. It's going to get a lot worse unless we step in and do these things.
Talking to Tom Palsiewicz, running as a Democrat to replace Jim Sensenbrenner in Wisconsin's 5th Congressional District. Now, the things you've mentioned so far, the stimulus costs a fair amount of money, some of the health care, same probably. Your opponent, Scott Fitzgerald, has cited the national debt as a concern in his campaign. Big deficit this year, $3 trillion for the year. Do you worry about the ability to pay for all the things you've just outlined?
Actually, at this point, it is the last thing we should be thinking about, because right now we need to make sure we can get the money into people's hands so they can keep not falling into poverty. That is step number one. Step number two is we'll figure out how to pay for it later. Here's the thing. Republicans have over and over again consistently cut taxes and created larger deficits. And there's never a discussion about whether we can pay for tax cuts. But whenever we need to spend money to make sure people don't fall into poverty, there's a discussion about the debt and deficit. And here we are, we're at $27 trillion when it comes to debt. We're going to have to figure out how to pay it off. But Republicans have consistently kicked that can down the road and basically said, all right, our children and our grandchildren are going to have to figure out how to pay that bill. I am a fiscal conservative. I think we do need to figure out ways to balance the budget in economically good times. And that is not the position we're in right now, because if we ran a fiscal surplus during good economic times, we'd have the money available to fill the gap during times like now. And we have to spend money right now to make sure that people don't fall into poverty.
How about the issue of police reform? Another big story in the United States, of course, social unrest after shootings in Minneapolis and here in Wisconsin. Do you think policing needs to change in some way? Do you support any kind of federal changes?
Well, I think it's more than just policing. We have a structural racism issue in our country, and we've had it for a long time. And it's now time to start doing something about it. One of the things I'm very grateful for is Milwaukee County declared racism to be a public health crisis. And that kicked off a whole bunch of different things that are happening in Milwaukee County right now. And they are leading in this effort. There are now a number of other municipalities around the country that are doing the same thing. But we need to change budgeting. We need to change the way that we do government budgeting through the lens of racial equity. We need to change our criminal justice system. We need to change policing. We need to change our healthcare system. There are a number of different systems that are tied into structural racism that unless we start figuring out how to do something about it, these incidents will continue to happen. I'm just a firm believer that racism is very hard to change in people, but structural racism can be overcome, but it's going to take all of us to do it.
Congress, for at least a couple decades now, has been trying to come up with some sort of comprehensive plan when it comes to the issue of immigration, whether taking it in bits and pieces or one big overall plan. What would your priorities be on that issue?
Well, I think we just need to solve the issue. You know, it's become a wedge issue, and I don't understand why, because this country needs good immigration on a consistent basis to keep our economy growing. You know, right now, our birth and death rates in our country are about even. And we're going to start sliding into a country that's actually contracting from a population standpoint. And immigration actually boosts our economy because people come in and want to do the jobs that other people have decided they don't want to do anymore. So we need a comprehensive immigration policy. But it's something that the United States was built on immigration. We all know this. We all realize it. And we offer people the American dream. So the idea that people want to come here and live is not something that should shock anybody. That's a good thing. We need to figure out a way to make it work for everybody, though.
Do you see ways to reach across the aisle and work, if you're elected, work with Republicans in the House on issues?
I've been doing this my whole life. You know, it's funny, when I ran against Jim Sensenbrenner in 2018, you know, I told people I was running. They said, oh, great, you're going to primary Jim Sensenbrenner. I said, no, I'm running as a Democrat. And they couldn't believe I was a Democrat. And I said, look, you weren't paying attention. You weren't listening. I care about equality. I care about justice. I care about fairness. And I think that as somebody who represents the Democratic Party, these are the things that we care about. But these are things that everybody cares about. And when I talk to Republicans, I talk to Democrats, when I talk to people, what I find is we all agree on almost 80% of any issue. It's just a question of how do we get moving? And in business, we get moving by doing something. And so my tagline in our campaign this time is progress over partisanship. Take steps. See if they work. Course correct if they don't, but keep moving toward a solution, because no one solution is the right solution. And I think that's where we need to get to. And we need to start agreeing on the issues and then start coming up with an idea of what are the things we're going to do to start solving them, not how to totally solve them, because that usually doesn't work.
We'll leave it there for now. Tom Palsowitz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
That's Tom Palsowitz running as a Democrat to replace Jim Sensenbrenner to represent Wisconsin's 5th Congressional District. His opponent is Republican and State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, who declined to join us for an interview today. Between now and the November general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates running in contested races for congressional seats here in Wisconsin to join us for interviews on Central Time and on the morning show. You can find all of those interviews and learn more about the candidates and races over at WPR.org/politics. That's WPR.org/politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, high school football is a popular activity for players, fans, and communities. We'll talk to a national education reporter about how schools and states are handling that fall tradition in the time of COVID-19. First, we take a look at the issue of sports during the pandemic from a different angle. Spectators are a big part of the sports experience, whether it's parents at a Pee Wee soccer game or diehard fans who might travel many miles to support their favorite college or pro sports team. During the time of the pandemic, some sports seasons have been canceled completely, but others are taking place under different and controlled conditions. One modification, many games are being played, but in empty gyms, stadiums, and arenas. We wondered how that might affect the athletes who are playing. Alan Chu is an assistant professor and the chair of the Sport, Exercise, and Performance Psychology Master's Program at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He's a certified mental performance consultant who works with athletes and coaches from high school to professional levels across sports on mental skills training. Alan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, during a normal athletic event, especially for younger athletes, how much of an impact can spectators have on the athletes who are playing?
Yeah, I mean, the impact of spectators are huge. You know, when you mention younger athletes, they need a lot of support from their family and friends in order to be able to play at the optimal level. And the support that they get usually get them feel more confident and also more focused in the game as well. Without fans, without spectators, it definitely takes a toll on their performance.
So what does it mean to you then if there are these games with no fans in the stands, no cheering at all after any play? How will that impact kids in particular?
Yeah, in general, there are two things that we said the fans has an impact on. You know, one thing is the attention and the focus. For example, in football or basketball, whenever you have a goal or whenever you do the touchdown, you know, you have people cheering on you and you feel excited about what you have achieved. But now you don't have that. And especially for kids, like I said, they need even more support from friends and family than the professional athlete. Because the professional athlete, they've been there for a long time and they know what they can accomplish. But the kids, they usually need additional support on that. So that's the kind of like the attention aspect. But then that's also kind of like the excitement that people bring or the general psychological arousal that the fans has. You know, it's not just about fans on your side, but also spectators of your opponent. Because sometimes getting those booing or getting people kind of like chanting on the other team, you know, we also have some psychological arousal and influence on your performance as well. So long story short, you know, definitely not having fans cannot get that physiological and psychological arousal that we usually have when we play competitions.
So even negative stuff, hearing cheering for the other team or booing for your team, that can get an athlete, that can motivate an athlete even if it isn't supportive?
Yeah, you're right. You know, because sometimes even getting some booing or getting some noises from the opponent actually motivate athlete. I would say it go either way. For athletes who don't feel confident, those may influence their performance negatively. But for competitive athletes, they usually enjoy in the environment. You know, maybe hearing some booing actually get them more motivated to perform at their best instead of hearing nothing. Because when you hear nothing and you don't have that physiological arousal, it's just really hard to play at your best level.
Now, I know I have been on some sidelines for my kids' sports, and there's a variety of behavior from parents. Sometimes parental behavior is pretty negative, not even just, good-natured booing or anything like that, but really negative stuff. Could it be helpful to kids to not have that kind of stuff on the sidelines?
Oh, that's a really good point that you mentioned. I would say yes. We've been talking about fan support and spectator chanting on their team, but I think one thing that may be helpful nowadays is not having those negative influences from other fans or from parents sometimes. And you're right, not having those could be helpful sometimes. The thing that we've been talking about, a positive support, but not having that negative influence could be helpful at certain times as well.
What would you say to a young athlete or maybe their parent or coach about how to stay motivated for someone who's used to hearing the crowd and now doesn't have that?
I would normally tell them to use their own voices. So in sports psychology, we talk about positive self-talk. So as athlete, they could use some positive self-talk, tell themselves, hey, let's go get the next play, get the next shot. Some of the self-talk that get them motivated to still keep playing. So it does need more coming from within than outside influence nowadays, that athletes have to motivate themselves through self-talk or sometimes even kind of like an imagery that we talk about visualization, visualizing themselves being successful, visualizing themselves playing at the best level in order to get that optimal physiological and psychological arousal.
Now, it seems like this might be easier to do for that kid who's a committed athlete. And as you mentioned, they're pretty motivated and competitive already. What about that less confident athlete? The one who's, they're hoping to play and have fun, but they don't feel as confident about their skills. What advice do you have for them in particular, especially maybe when they don't have that supportive parent on the sideline now?
Yeah, if it's a younger kid or more recreational level, I think the coaches may need to do a little bit more work to give them more positive support. And I would even encourage coaches to come meet with athletes individually to see what they need during these unprecedented times, what support they will need from the coach. Sometimes the kid may say, I don't need anything. I may just need to play on my own. But there may be another kid that, I don't have any parents or friends cheering on me on the side. I would like you to maybe give me some encouragement during certain point of the match or the competition in order to play at my best. So I think as a coach, it would be important for the coaches to check in with athletes to see what they need and maybe do some simulation training at practices, trying to simulate practice with a lower intensity. In a normal world, we encourage coaches to simulate their training with high intensity, a lot of noises, a lot of intensity, a lot of yelling to just get them in a competition mode. But nowadays, probably need to tone it down a little bit to mimic what's happening in the competition with no fans around them.
And Alan, before we wrap up, I understand from biography you are a pretty serious table tennis player. I'm looking at a picture of you on the UW Green Bay website at the table, getting ready to slam the ball, I think. I just imagine you've played in front of crowds and in front of nobody. Does it feel different for you?
Oh, yeah, it does. Especially when my teammates are there cheering on me, it makes a huge difference. I remember the best match that I played in college, I was actually playing against somebody who had a higher level than me, but with the teammates cheering on me, in that moment, I felt like I have nothing to lose. I was going to just play every shot I could, and I wasn't thinking about the outcome. Just be in the moment when teammates believe me, versus not having someone on my side. I would sometimes doubt, okay, should I play this shot, or I would be thinking about the outcome rather than just focusing in the moment when people are on my side.
Alan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me again.
Alan Chu is an assistant professor and chair of the Sport, Exercise, and Performance Psychology Master's Program at UW Green Bay. He was with us to talk about the effect on athletes when there are no fans in the stands. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. This year's Fermentation Fest ran from September 26th to October 4th. Producer Steve Gotcher took the Farm Art Detour, and here's what he found.
Fermentation Fest has been celebrating all things live culture for more than a decade. And the festival's Farm Art Detour sends people on a 50-mile journey, teaching them about microbes and showcasing artwork and roadside poetry, all while socially distant. Donna Newworth is the executive director of Worm Farm Institute, the group responsible for the tour.
Fermentation is about abundance and transformation. So whether it's from milk to cheese or grain to beer, or from one sort of community to another, it's about that kind of abundance and transformation and how one thing turns into another thing and has greater value and longer shelf life. So what we were trying to do is invite people to come closer. But the 40 stops on that 50-mile route are interspersed with what farmers do every day.
My wife, Heike, and I had heard of Fermentation Fest and thought driving through the Farm Art Detour would be a fun excuse to get out of the house. But driving to Sauk City from Madison, we had no idea what we were getting into. We meandered through small towns, churchyards, and farm fields set against the gorgeous backdrop of Sauk County's dynamic countryside. After a quick stop in Sauk City to pick up a map of the tour, we discovered a website that plays a tour-length sound symphony. Following a GPS in an app, it plays sounds and music at different locations. Designer Hugh Livingston drove the tour route twice a day for 2 weeks, logging 1,800 miles to make sure the sounds played at precise spots along the journey. The result created a stunning soundtrack for the tour. Just outside of Sauk City, voices of Cistercian nuns from Valley of Our Lady Monastery filled the car as we passed a poem printed on a series of signs along the road.
Oh, here's something up here. What's this?
From rot to riches, compost's holy work, to worship, I go to church with a pitchfork. That was a poem by Woody Leslie.
A few miles later, we passed an old fire truck by the side of the road and heard the sound of a small stream as we crossed a bridge. In the distance, the Baraboo Hills rolled across the horizon as a voice recited the words of Frank Lloyd Wright, commenting on the beauty of Sauk County.
Cradles you as do these southwestern Wisconsin hills.
Along the route, art creations dotted the landscape. We stopped at an earthwork sculpture in the form of a ship's prow emerging from the side of a gently sloping hill in a field of kernza. Kernza is a perennial grain that can be made into flour. Tori Tepp, the creator of this art project, explains how this work came about.
This is called the Sauk County Arc, and that stands for the Agricultural Recon Craft. But my collaborating partner are the Gasser family, and they own Tower Rock Bakery just down the street. So this is kind of an experiment for us both, and when we harvest next summer, we're going to see if we can incorporate some of the kernza into their bread making or pastry making. And then the earthwork itself is kind of in the form of a ship or a shipwreck. All of this is from, you know, old agriculture, mm-hmm. and then the idea is that ryegrass and all of these little gardens of cover crops and the kernza, this is opportunity to move forward with new agriculture.
The tour continued from farm to farm and valley to valley with various art displays along the way. The soundscape moved from natural sounds to discussions of dairy farming and oral collages of farming sounds.
We would be the last dairy.
50 miles later, we found ourselves back in Sauk City, reflecting on all that we'd seen and heard. Donna Newworth summed up best what participating in Fermentation Fest is all about.
It's re-knitting together urban and rural concerns around land and nourishment. And I think that those things will always be critical. And this is just a fun, exciting way to kind of bring people into that experience.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
High school football is a big deal in a lot of communities around Wisconsin and across the country. But like many things during the coronavirus pandemic, it looks different depending on where you live. Some communities have gone ahead with the games, others postponed or canceled, and some are in the midst of legal battles. Erin Richards is a Milwaukee-based national education reporter at USA Today. She took a look at how the issue is playing out in her recent piece titled High School Football is the New Battleground of COVID-19 School Reopenings. Erin, good to have you back with us.
It's good to be here.
What's the range of approaches we're seeing around the country right now, Erin, when it comes to whether and how to tackle these games?
There's a huge range, and it goes from everything that looks pretty much like a normal football season, albeit one that may have started a bit late and has a lot more people wearing masks in the crowds, to absolutely no football at all for the fall season, which is where students in Milwaukee and Madison, two of our largest districts, find themselves. No in-person school, no in-person sports for those districts.
And when that happens, it has been a controversial decision. Can you talk about some of the pushback that you've seen when districts or counties cancel their games?
Right. So one of the issues is that the CDC classifies football as a high-risk sport. Other sports that students play and that youth play may be medium risk or pretty low risk. You know, running alone on a track may be pretty low risk. Volleyball is a medium risk for most states. But the CDC hasn't told districts exactly what to do, or, you know, if you have this level of virus infection rates in your community, don't hold sports. So it's really come down to individual decisions by governors, and then in cooperation with the state athletics associations that typically run these tournaments. And what's happened in some states like Illinois, where there are, where no football, football is considered high risk, it's been postponed to the spring, is that you're seeing parents rise up and in some cases even sue the athletics associations or the state for the right to play high school football.
Right. This is another one of those COVID-19 cases where there's no happy, perfect answer, right? There's risks to the community of having the game, but people really do get hit hard if they don't have their extracurricular activities, sports, and otherwise. Can you talk about the concerns people have raised when the games don't happen?
Of course. So athletics, just like any other extracurricular activity that's tied to school or tied to, you know, youth activity in general, are seen as really important outlets. I mean, this is a time when a lot of kids are not living their normal lives. Many of them are learning at home on computers. They're not seeing as many friends. And a lot of people say, you know, sports are something that often happens outside. There's ways to do it safely. These are important outlets for kids, not only physical growth, but also their emotional growth. It keeps them connected to school. It gives them motivation to work for something. And yet on the other side of the fence, you've got people saying, look, this is a pandemic. And already we've seen some places that are playing games have had to quarantine entire football teams. In one case, a young coach in, I believe it was Texas, died after contracting the virus. So there are certainly risks here. And depending on who you talk to, and there are certainly plenty of doctors who say, look, you know, playing sport, the risk of playing sports outweighs staying home because it's good for kids' development. But you can find other, certainly parents and doctors who say, look, it's just too dangerous right now. How about we wait until spring until we can see where the cases are in, you know, January or early winter.
Talking to Erin Richards, Milwaukee-based national education reporter at USA Today, talking about how states and communities are handling high school sports, whether they should happen, what kind of extra precautions. Let's head off the field, Erin, and into the stands. Mask requirements in many places, but not always welcomed by fans. What kind of disputes are we seeing?
So once you get past the decision of whether to play or not, which is often out of an individual school district's hands, you get down to the nitty-gritty of what play and what competitions will look like. And those are controlled by individual districts and even individual high schools who may say, we only want our home team families in the stands and not families from visiting teams. One superintendent in another state took that route and faced a lot of backlash from parents who said, well, this is crazy. Other districts aren't requiring visiting teams' families to stay away. In many cases, we've got pretty strict, you know, security at football games and school security wandering around telling people to put masks on if they're not wearing them. That has been met with resistance by at least one mom in Ohio who resisted wearing a mask and then was told she was trespassing. And when she refused to leave the game, was tased by a school security official. So we've seen the range of human behavior. And in many ways, it's the same conflict and often, you know, political divide over wearing a mask or not, that plays out in society and in different communities is also just kind of now playing out in the stands at certain games. And to be fair, there have been many instances where all the football players are wearing masks, people in the stands are wearing masks, and more or less the game is going on as scheduled.
Right. I don't want to overemphasize the negative interactions here, given that it sounds like the majority of people are taking the precautions that they can.
Yes. And the players I've talked to who are playing are really grateful to be doing it, as are the coaches. I'm just in the middle here, like a referee sort of just calling the shots. But I can understand how important this could be to students, especially students in a position to potentially get that last footage in to be looked at for a college scholarship. And if you can't get those plays in right now, and maybe, you know, players in another community or another state are, does that put you at a disadvantage because you live there? And in some cases, you know, I interviewed a young man who had his mom lives in Illinois. His dad lives in Michigan. And so he moved to Michigan so he could play football there. He can't play with his home high school in Illinois near Chicago. So he transferred districts and started playing football for a brand new school outside of Detroit.
In our last minute, Aaron, football, of course, outside. Basketball season is coming. Lots of indoor sports coming. Do you have a sense of how schools are trying to prepare for that potentially higher risk situation?
I can't imagine that school districts and even athletics associations aren't watching the outbreaks, or at least the number of quarantines that are happening among football teams, given that so many precautions have already been taken and football is an outside sport. I can only imagine that they will try to be even more strict with mask wearing and as much distancing as possible for the indoor sports. But I am going to be very interested to see how we control, or, you know, what's the mechanism for limiting the number of people in the stands for a popular home basketball game. I don't know what that's going to look like yet. Many districts and states have postponed their other fall sports until spring. Those athletes will presumably have to start practicing indoors in many places because it won't be conducive to outdoor practice. So it's going to be really interesting to watch how and whether these sports can proceed and if they can do so safely.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Aaron Richards is a Milwaukee-based national education reporter with USA Today. She joined us today to talk about how high schools around the country and states are dealing with COVID-19 and the fall sports season.